From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We're, I guess, going to pick up where we have been sort of treading for the past few weeks now. We'll pick up where we left off last week, looking at an overview of the general political and economic trends, particularly with this coronavirus overlay on top of things, how people have been coping, what's been working as a strategy, whatnot, and then, of course, all the other things that just go on as a part of daily life.
Yeah, thanks, Don. You may hear music in the background, and that's because we've got some music classes still happening here.
Great.
At our community center, so I hope that doesn't interrupt our conversation too much.
Maybe it'll keep the parrots quiet anyway.
So I'm taking up where we left off last time. We were talking about the various policy responses to the very multifaceted crisis that is overtaking not just Latin America and the Caribbean, but the whole of the Americas and a lot of the world as well. And we were looking at the way the an institution like the Inter-American Development Bank will come out with neoliberal policy recommendations, and then a more social democrat outfit linked to the UN, like the UN Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, will come up with slightly less stringent kind of policy proposals, including a strong element of social concern. And then the last option we were looking at was the more radical revolutionary option developed by the countries of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas.
Right.
And I'd like to carry on looking at that, but I'd like specifically to kind of take note, as it were, of the really, really acute and extreme inequality that is developing even more now as a result of the measures taken against the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. Because, and I'm sure most of our listeners living in the United States will know very well the elite are doing exceptionally well. And Walmart and Amazon, for example,
right.
Jeff Bezos is supposed to have, in inverted commas, earned $29 billion just right. Between March and May of this year,
right.
Largely as a result of the effects of the lockdown, because people can't go to the mom and pop store on the corner anymore if that's where they went.
Right.
And so their own Amazon sales have soared.
He supposedly has made more money in the past 2 months than any human being in history before.
Right. And at the same time, more or less in the same period coming into June, you now have in the United States 47 million U.S. workers seeking unemployment insurance. So you have this really stark contrast whereby, whereas every economist, even neoliberal economists, will recognize that inequality in society is not good in terms of that society's overall prosperity. But what you've got happening now in the United States, and perhaps we can talk a bit about the effects of this in Latin America and the Caribbean, is this really stark, marked increase, a grotesque increase in inequality. And there's similar trends in Europe, perhaps not quite so extreme as the example of Jeff Bezos. But it seems to me that what this makes clear is that the Western elites in general, both in North America and Europe, and obviously that has very strong effects in Latin America and the Caribbean, are aggressively seeking to recover levels of profitability that have been steadily declining for the last, 30, 40 years?
Right.
And that they're doing that via a ruthless, all-out attack on labor, because what's going to happen, even when the pandemic is eventually declared to be over in a lot of places. It is in effect over. If you look at the curve of the progression of fatalities and cases in Western Europe, and in effect the pandemic is over. But what you're going to find in both Europe and in the United States is when all those 47 million US workers and their counterparts in Europe go back looking for their job isn't going to be there.
Right.
And all those mom and pop stores that have had to shut down as a result of the great confinement, the quarantine, a lot of those mom and pop stores and small businesses and even medium-sized businesses just aren't going to be able to survive.
Right.
So what's going to happen? Do you have a sense of how desperate things are in the States? Is that a misperception?
Well, you know, getting a sense of anything here is very difficult. First of all, people are, you know, they're not meeting in the usual places. The water cooler talk that usually, you know, is the business days version of kitchen talk, where people congregate around the water cooler and, you know, trade battle stories. That no one's going into the office, you know, or except for the, you know, essentials or whatever, and mostly they're not sitting around chit-chatting about their situation. A much larger share, in any event, of the contact that people have is mediated, through just platforms, you know, like their phone or Facebook Messenger or whatever, but still some probably direct contact, or through social media and or the regular media, where, you know, I don't know what's going on anyplace else except for what's on the local news. Oh, yeah, that's the restaurant I used to eat at. Oh, that's what happened to her. She usually waited on my table. You know, now she's working at the car wash because it's the only job she could have. In other words, the people themselves don't really know what's going on outside of their immediate environment because of the nature of this isolating, you know, the social isolating that's been imposed.
Right.
That's part of it. In addition to that, the trend, as you mentioned before, for 30, 40 years, has been, you know, deeper and deeper exploitation of the workers, rising unemployment, stagflation, stagployment, you know, all of those things that everyone's familiar with, all the manufacturing jobs, you know, being swept out and sent to low wage, places, standard unemployment that's really in the, you know, double digits all the time. They recalculated the method of determining who's unemployed by saying, well, yeah, maybe you haven't had a job for 20 years, but you stopped looking, so you're not unemployed. They suddenly, in the United States, this was like Trump's big, you know, task, to put people back to work. They suddenly drove unemployment down in the United States to real 4% and 5% unemployment, and that was different, but that got almost no play in the media other than a statement of the fact. The only knowledge of it that people had was, you know, people that had no job before and couldn't find a job suddenly were working. But in terms of the sociological phenomenon that, you know, surrounds that, the media was in the process, you know, was basically denying that it happened and that it was happening, or poo-pooing it. And you had Nancy Pelosi saying, well, you know, these jobs suck, I think was the term she used, and downplaying the, you know, the fact that there was this measurable, you know, the actual calculus of it, the means that people use to calculate employment was the best that it had been since Reagan, you know, since like Patco and stuff. So that's kind of percolating out there also, and you have, you know, some rising expectations that went along with that. You know, somebody in the family gets a job, then somebody else does. Now the other two people who've been looking for jobs have like a real hope that they're going to get one too, and then you have this, you know, dump in the economy that took place with the shutdown, with the, you know, over the pandemic. So, you know, generally, the most volatile times politically are when you have rising expectations and, you know, a sudden disappointment, you know, of that. You know, people are expecting that things are going to be terrible, and then they are terrible. You know, sometimes they're motivated to change it, but, you know, other times, you know, they're not. It's just like, well, things are terrible. That's how things are. But if people are expecting things to get better, and they get a little taste of it getting better, and then it's taken away from them, very often that will, you know, this is measurable. That is more indicative of a pre-revolutionary condition than the earlier one, depending on how desperate people are. So, you know, kind of parsing all of that here in the United States right now is difficult. You had in June, 4.8 million jobs got added again. You know, that was that. In other words, after the dump in employment, we suffered like a month and a half of a slide, looking almost like a collapse. With all of the people who were, you know, suddenly unemployed, restaurant workers, you know, everyone pretty much. Suddenly, when they started to, you know, allow people to go back to work, it was much faster and a much stronger surge than people were predicting. Again, it was almost 5 million jobs in 1 month. That's phenomenal. Now, we're going to see what happens in July, and there's all kinds of political, this is an election year. Suffice to say that plenty of people in the political sphere will tell you almost out front, I would rather you were unemployed than that you got a job and voted for my opponent.
Right.
And so there's the phenomenon going on, like with the Republican National Convention was scheduled to be in North Carolina, Raleigh, North Carolina. And is it Raleigh? I think it one of those cities down there. And but the governor there is a Democrat, so they start talking about, well, everybody at this convention is going to have to wear a mask and a spacesuit, and you have to stay 182 feet away from each other, et cetera, et cetera. You know, in other words, we're going to use this police power that we have in the pandemic emergency to manipulate things politically to the maximum that we can. And Trump saying, oh, no, you're not. We're moving the convention. And so they, except for the opening day, they're moving the balance of it with a few $100 million worth of, you know, business down to Jacksonville, Florida, which has a Republican governor, and said, come on down here. You know, we'll let you cough in our face or whatever. In other words, the opposite. So where people would normally be looking at their immediate condition economically, you know, good, bad, or indifferent as one thing, then a backdrop of some reliable, you know, a couple of doctors in white coats on TV telling them, look, this is what we got to do, nice and calm, reliable information, and people looking at them like they're Jonas Salk, you know, they would have in the 1950s or something. Instead, you have this naked political game going on in front of people who already don't have any faith in this system anymore because that's been going on for so long. So how this plays out, you know, you have the cloth of the population. In other words, what's their reaction going to be to no matter what actually happens? That's unpredictable. Right. And the outcome for the people in terms of, you know, jobs and, you know, economic, you know, condition at the end of this or whatever, also very, you know, very difficult to predict, certainly. And, you know, looking at through a Marxist lens, of course, this being, you know, late capitalist imperialism epic, sooner or later, there's, you know, a dustbin, you know, around the corner for the whole, you know, mechanical process of running this economy. That generally means that my job security might be questioned too, no matter what kind of job I have. So you have that going on, and some people actually aware of that, you know, as a part of their worldview. And then you have the political posturing and the, you know, the profiteering that go on around a situation where you have an emergency, where people are scared, where information is controlled in a central place, and where people have very little faith in their institutions. That's kind of the cloth that's sort of the soil that this whole thing is, you know, growing in.
Right. Well, yeah, I think you find that across Latin America and the Caribbean, then, that the general populations will be in a very similar situation. although without the particular political nuances that you've been talking about there in the United States. Right. But in any case, I mean, the upshot here in Latin America and the Caribbean of this tremendous offensive, because we do tend to see it as that here in the region, and people who are very conscious of the need for progressive radical revolutionary change in order to give people even a basic decent life here in Latin America and the Caribbean. We're very conscious of the fact that Western Europe and North America are the elites that run those the countries of those regions are very much engaged in a ruthless assault against the living standards of their own populations, and by implication, the populations here in the region. So any country, and if people say, well, why are they using these coercive, illegal, unilateral measures against Venezuela? Why are they using them against Cuba? Why are they using them against Nicaragua? The reason is because any country espousing anything even remotely resembling socialism, or even slightly questioning US and European elite dominance in the region,
right,
are going to get attacked in the most ruthless, comprehensive way.
Right.
And so, and what you therefore have in the same way that we perceive an attack on working people, ordinary people in the United States, in order to reinstate the viability of the neoliberal capitalist project in North America and Western Europe, here we see in Latin America and the Caribbean an attack on the low-income majority that in some ways is more direct even than the overt class war that you have in the United States, the war that Warren Buffett acknowledged and which he said that his class was winning, right?
Right.
So, and here the whereas in the United States you have a kind of the social policy has repressive characteristics like the indiscriminate murder of black people, and here in the region and in countries like Colombia and Mexico, the violence is much more carefully targeted. For example, in Colombia this year, 159 community and indigenous leaders have been murdered. Now, if that had been, and we said this so many times, if that were to happen in Venezuela or Cuba or or Nicaragua, and the sky would fall, and there would be a complete psychological warfare, diplomatic, trade, economic offensive against, as there is, against our countries, but nothing happens to Colombia. Of course not, because Colombia's a stalwart US ally, so they can kill as many social leaders as they like.
Right.
And nothing's going to happen. And ditto the more than 200 ex-FARC fighters who demobilized under the peace agreement of 2016 have now been murdered in the same circumstances as all those community and social leaders. And nothing gets said about those gross violations of people's basic human rights. And then another example of the form that the attack of the Western elites takes against progressive political options here in the region is the most blatant abuse of the law, of judicial procedures, of what people call lawfare. And you can see that time and time again. And In Brazil against Lula da Silva, in Argentina, not now under the current government of Alberto Fernandez, but under the previous government of Mauricio Macri,
right,
a really ruthless kind of legal stalking of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And of course, in Ecuador, you have this completely spurious case against Rafael Correa,
right,
and his former vice president, and Lenin Moreno's former vice president, Jorge Glass, who's completely unjustly in jail. And now in Bolivia, under the de facto coup regime there, they're now using or seeking to use Bolivia's legal system to proscribe the mass political party, which is favorite to win the elections that are now scheduled for, I think, December the 6th.
Wow.
Well, sorry, I've got that wrong. September, they're scheduled for September. The elections in Venezuela that will be on December 6th. President Añez, the usurper coup regime president in Bolivia, is now exploiting Bolivia's legal system to try and proscribe mass and prevent them from participating in the elections. And they're also trying to institute criminal proceedings against former President Evo Morales. So, and that's just the latest example of the way the law is abused in the region for political ends. And then, as I mentioned earlier, against Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela, the United States and its allied elites in Canada and Western Europe are intensifying the illegal, coercive, unilateral measures, completely illegal in under international law.
Even Switzerland. That's the weirdest thing I ever saw. I mean, that's usually the Nazis are welcome to come hide their money here, but we're going to sanction Nicaragua.
Right, and which is it's completely bizarre, and I think they're not actually sanctioning the country. I think they're sanctioning individuals, as if anybody in Nicaragua is going to have a Swiss bank account.
Right.
But anyway, that gives you an idea of how absurd and extreme and bizarre these measures end up being, and so you have those kind of direct expressions of this Western elite attack on progressive options in Latin America and the Caribbean. And you also have these indirect kind of, more indirect forms of an attack. For example, and this is particularly relevant in the case of Argentina, perhaps less so in the case of Mexico. But in Argentina, the use of debt and indebtedness to attack the impoverished majority in the region is very, very clear. And Argentina is currently, they're just in the process of making a final offer to foreign bondholders of $65 billion of Argentina's foreign debt. And the interesting thing about that is that, and the markets are very pleased with the kind of offer that Argentina's making, because the price that Argentina is offering and the outlook over the next 3, 4, 5 years means that any of the people who are accepting that offer are likely to make a strong profit some years down the line. And that goes completely against the argument of the ALBA countries, which has been for a cancellation of the debt, because the debt just hobbles economies in the region and makes it impossible for them to meet objectives of poverty reduction of extreme poverty, to meeting even basic stuff, basic climate change commitments under the Paris Agreement, and a whole series of consequences that flow from having to allocate a large chunk of your annual budget to repaying foreign creditors.
Right.
So then, and maybe we can talk a bit more about that in a moment. But so the economic contraction that faces the region, according to the projections from the relevant international financial institutions, is going to be of the order of anything between 5.5% and 6%. I think that's optimistic. I think it's going to be worse.
Probably.
But I hope I'm wrong. But what you're actually talking about in terms, for people who are familiar with economic history at all, you're talking about something that's as bad as the Great Depression of the 19th century that lasted 20 years from 1870 to 1890.
Yeah.
The Great Depression of 1929 to 1940. And that's what we're looking at. And that might be what people are looking at in North America and Europe as well. And I suspect that is the case, but it's certainly the case here in Latin America and the Caribbean. So what that implies, zero prospects for any enlightened redistribution. but every prospect of deepening irrational exploitation of the region, and especially the region's natural resources, of course, by foreign corporations and foreign interests, because countries will be so desperate to try and generate income to meet the needs of their majorities, and to try and get their economies something like back on track towards something resembling prosperity, that they'll strike any deal going in order to get income, which is bad news for the region's natural resources and for anything to do with trying to mitigate climate change. So there, and there you have that's the overall situation. And what that means, and that is what makes the policy proposals of the ALBA countries so desperately important, because what they're saying is, let me see if I can find the file, Don. I didn't open the file in order to look at the policy options. I'm sorry to.
Yeah, that's right. So meanwhile, one of the things that I'm looking at is, and we've got about 3 minutes left also, is this election in Guyana that's still hanging out there now. Was 4 months later? I guess it was in March was the election, and they're still, they're so close. Like all of the other countries in the region, and including the United States, by the way, the society is like ripped in half essentially, and the legislature is like one vote more on one side than the other, depending on. Year to year, there's 65 members in a National Assembly, and it's 32 to 33 or 31, to 34 or whatever, like all the time. And it flips from one side to the other. So, and now you've got Irfan Ali, supposedly is the winner, according to the court, and you've got the OAS choosing up sides, and, the U.S.-backed Organization of American States, CARICOM and others all, saying we think it should be this one or that one. And, Guyana is, it's an important place in this whole, configuration here. And go ahead.
Sorry, Don. And Guyana's taken its territorial dispute with Venezuela over the Essequibo area of the country, in the west of the country, that Venezuela has been claiming as its own for decades. And Guyana's taken it to the International Court of Justice, but Venezuela refuses to accept that the court court has jurisdiction. So it's, who knows how that's going to pan out. But Guyana's just another example of what we were talking about earlier, of the way the United States and its allies intervene in the region in order to prevent the development of any progressive option. Yeah. And in the Dominican Republic's elections on Sunday, the guy that won those elections is a kind of a social democrat character, Luis Abinader. He won very handily in the elections, but it's extremely unlikely that there's going to be any significant policy change in the Dominican Republic, and they'll continue to tend to vote alongside other United States allies in the region, although previously the Dominican Republic was quite favorable to Venezuela. And I think those days are gone, and I think that that's very much along the lines of somewhere like Costa Rica or some similar country, Panama, in terms of its foreign policy.
Well, we're going to have to come back to this next week. We're out of time. This is it's a real complex map. And I'm sorry to have to break in here at this point, but we are definitely out of time. So we will pick it up here next week. And I'd like to thank you again for your time and patience, Tony, and look forward to speaking with you then. Yeah.
Thanks a million, Don. I look forward to carrying on next week.
Yep, we will. Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.